Good afternoon. I can not believe that this is the very end, the last talk of the last day. But it is. Here we are. It has so many emotional qualities this last day. It's very sad for me to say goodbye to everyone. We become so close in ways that just aren't possible any other way. And I know you all have been working so hard and working knee to knee and elbow to elbow, hour after hour, doing so many things. It creates a world, a whole life and a world, simply by our being together like this. And I suppose that most of us, as we're sitting now, are finding that home is entering our minds, that we have things to do and people who are waiting for us, and it can't be helped that this little pure, austere little world that we made is already falling apart. Koban said, gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha, means falling apart, always, always falling apart. But I think we can be very happy about how this happened, how we happened here, how the whole of it took on a life of its own, sustained by everyone in a way that we long for in human life. And it's hard to find. So we can cherish that we did this. We can't take it home with us. And sometimes there's a huge disappointment getting home through all the traffic and then finding situations that aren't even welcoming particularly. Maybe even a little resentful. Oh, we've been up here cooling our heels while they've been working all this time and taking care of everything. So it's very well to go with a very deeply caring mind and realize you can't take Sesshin with you, but you can take your own mind, the depths that you've discovered, the wisdom that you have contacted and developed and enjoyed as your gift to your world. What we do is what the world longs for. And it takes a lot of effort to come to this. And we know how, but many people don't. And many people are afraid of it. So we can't go around and be telling everybody, oh, there's this cool thing that we do and we should all be doing it. All we can take is our own sincerity and authenticity and kindness. And just be there with everyone. And all by itself, that's an inspiration. Inspire means to take it in, a breath. So you will bring your care in a way that people will feel, if not find any words for. So let that be enough. It's a question what home is. We say we're going home. If we become monks in a temple or a monastery, we vow to leave home. That's what monk's ordination means, home leaving. Something gets dropped off. I suffered over that when I was young, realizing there was no way I could leave home. Although I knew what it meant, I thought I knew what it meant. It meant cutting the ties and being a kind of free agent. It's not a disconnect, but it's... I can't think of a word for it. It's being without a home and being willing to be at home anywhere. Glad for any bed that becomes available in any country in the world. And I slowly realized that, of course, it's possible to live that way and raise a family as well. It's not easy, but it's possible. And some of us here have done that, have in some sense left home and stayed home at the same time. It's the harder practice, I would say, if you had to measure it, which of course you don't. We can't decide these things. But it's a difficult way. And it's one that we've all chosen here. We're going back to another world and bringing our wisdom with us. So Dogen says, one thing that can help us is to only speak when we feel we have something wise to say. That's very, very helpful. Because our human life is so full of talk, and much of it is so careless. It's hard to know how to monitor and care for it. But we all know this wisdom that's been helping us. And if we use wisdom to respond, that creates so much space and so much time that the things we've been talking about allowing the experience of everything to actually become a part of our living experience, to be open to the world, to the universe. But as we were saying, you can't be open and get overrun by everything. And only we have control of that. It's how we respond wisely and quietly. that we impose silence on sesshin is for a reason, because usually we don't even experience silence in our ordinary life. But this is something we can bring to our own home life. So I'm supposed to wait till tomorrow, but I just want to mention that how impressed I am with how many of us came not knowing a lot of the different jobs and how well they got all filled. How willing everyone was to learn new things. That's always extremely helpful and really fun. Once you realize that you can do it. And you did that. It was great to watch. So a monk asked Yung Yan, what is the body beyond the Dharmakaya? The Buddha body. You know, we chant three kayas, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. And those are very mysterious kinds of ways of expressing the untalkaboutable. And the Dharmakaya is all of it. The all of it and beyond the all of it. Sometimes it's described, Dharmakaya, as the sun, as a life-giving force, and Sambhogakaya as the light of the sun, by which everything is living. And Nirmanakaya is each ordinary everyone, who is enlivened by this life force. But it's even bigger than this. We can't even really picture such a thing. And yet we call on it. We call on it at the very first of a meal. Dharmakaya, Virochana, Buddha. There's a wonderful Buddha in, I think, the Freer Gallery in Washington that shows a monk standing in a beautiful robe that is covered with beautiful little, I guess it was modeled in clay and then cast in bronze. And it seems it's a little river running through and a village and people and animals and a forest, and it's just everything. And he's wearing it. So a monk asked Yung Yan, what's beyond that? Because it's just one more cheap idea, right? It's just one more thing to say, even though it's more than that. And Yung Yan said, the body's beyond the Big Dipper. It's way out there. Dogen said, well, he said, Yuyan couldn't say anything beyond the Dharma body. If someone were to ask me, said Dogen, I'd say the body is hidden within the Dharma body. right here. So that's what I brought to say. It's time for questions, comments.
Why is it hidden within the Dharma body?
We don't see it. Feels like it's hidden.
And when you look inside for it, you can't find it.
Yes.
But it's clear it's right here.
Yes. Excuse me.
Who is hidden it?
Excuse me?
If it's hidden, who is hidden it? Is it hidden from us, or do we hide it?
I think we hide it. I don't think it's hiding at all. Dogen said there is nothing hidden. So it's kind of a joke. John?
Could be a metaphor for the unknown.
Therefore known?
It could be a metaphor for the unknown.
It's the untalkaboutable, the unknown. It's not even unknown. That's why it's so difficult. I mean, here we are, and we're talking about something, but we can't say what it is. And often our life is paradoxical in this way. There's a koan where a couple of monks are looking at a coffin, and one of them says, where did he go, the dead person? And the other monk says, can't say. There's some things that we are helpless to express, even though we feel it. And that's why this practice is so mysterious in a way, because it brings up so much experience of the unsayable. Yeah.
So maybe it's just hidden from our ordinary way of expressing.
No doubt. That's why it's so helpful to sit down and be quiet for a while, so that we begin to listen and to sense what else is happening besides our own often crazed thought that's trying to figure everything out. We can't figure it out, but we can be with it. And take refuge in it. That's the other part of our practice, is taking refuge. We can step back and make ourselves safe. It's what we depend on that I was talking about the other day. Inherent in us. But we need to practice it. It's not It's just not something you can get. It means we ourselves have to be it. Or recognize that we are it. Abby?
I want to just say, just week for me, I mean, I heard at the beginning someone asked you, like, how can I, or I would say to myself, how can I open my heart? It feels still so closed. But having just been in this Sesshin and seeing how everybody is doing everything they possibly can to the best has opened up my heart so much more. Mm-hmm. Just witnessing and feeling and seeing, you know, somebody getting up to do the han, and somebody else stepping in for me to serve the tea when my knee went out, and shopping and lugging and all the stuff that we don't even, the stuff even before and after the Sesshin, and it just opened my heart so much that I'm quite happy about that and realizing it can open up. And I was thinking the same in my corner there today. It is a remarkable experience. Thank you.
Thinking about this body hidden within the Dharma body, and it made me think about how it's something that when you seek or when you look for it, you can't find it. And that there's a lot of, I think the sitting for me, this whole Sesshin was, you know, it's kind of like the, almost like the ignorance of enlightenment is enlightenment. And how oftentimes we can be so fixated on trying to find something, we kind of miss the whole point of it, you know, where it's kind of like, enlightenment is not something that occurs within me as an individual, but it's literally the whole world already as it is enlightenment.
Yeah.
And one thing that I feel very grateful for kind of to everybody here is that I think it's this, you know, this very deep realization that the practice of coming together is the manifestation of, you could say, like, of the Nirmanakaya, mm-hmm. or it's like the Dharmakaya is us practicing here, and that this is kind of bringing heaven to earth, so to speak, and it made me feel just incredibly thankful to just realize that it's just that taking that position of gratitude was kind of the fulfillment, you know, of itself. You know, that there was nothing else mm-hmm. that one needed to add but to participate and be thankful in the midst of it. And I think it's a subtle thing, right? Because we can think that, like, well, maybe it's something that I'm supposed to seek out in you. You know, and maybe you're going to give it to me, you know, or maybe I'm going to find it at some point on the cushion.
Yes.
You know, or maybe at some point I'm going to have this big aha moment that comes. And all the while, it's actually every moment that we're all here together.
It's already.
Yeah, it already is.
Yes. And not just here. It's wherever.
Right.
The recognition is a different matter. That's what practice is.
Right. So the first session I had with you, I had this interesting, related to your, the kind of like taking this back into the world. And I was reminded of this time, the first time I met my former teacher, Andrew, this woman had obviously this kind of, you know, aha moment during his talk. And she was like, Andrew,
you know, how do we take this into the world? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, like, how do I fit this into my life? And he said, don't try to fit it into your life, fit your life into it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because my understanding has kind of changed, and it changed after I had that first session with you, which was don't do anything with it at all. Just let go, can keep letting go. Because the whole idea that you're going to take something from here is kind of like going right back into the seeking.
It's the same.
It's the seeking and the having. And that it's kind of like you came here with nothing and you're going to leave here with nothing. Don't try to hold on to it.
Yes. Precisely.
But that's like, that is carrying it forward. You know, that's the only way you can really do it, is by trying to let go of it.
It's very important not to try to be somebody. And especially important not to be a Zen person.
Oh my God.
That's the worst. You're right. It's.
But it was a big moment. I remember, like, just kind of like, oh my God, you know, it's like I don't have to worry about trying to take the revelation or whatever. Yes. I thought I had gained.
Yes.
You know, that you can kind of just leave it all. Last thing I just wanted to mention was something interesting occurred, I felt, yesterday that I thought I would try to maybe bring some attention towards. And it was after Carol's talk, and there was this moment when it was like there was this whole issue around faith, and then that kind of obviously felt significant to kind of talk about more, and David spoke about it a little bit. He kind of talked about it, and then like I talked about it, and then the guy behind me talked about it, and then Ryan spoke about it. And it was interesting because when I practiced with my teacher previously, we talked, we practiced a lot of what we called like collective intelligence, or we called it like enlightened communication. And it was interesting because a lot of that was working towards kind of building up this like spark of inquiry, where when you follow a thread carefully with like kind of sincerity, interest, you know, and care, and we are all interested in it together, but we bring our attention outside of the whole interior dialogue, and we really lean into it, you can feel that suddenly like we can grow in greater depth, you know. And that's kind of what I realized, and it's kind of like what was happening. It was almost like a spark kind of like left from Carol, and like, and it started to get a bit larger and a bit larger, right? You could feel it. It's like the room becomes like more enlightened. You know, you can kind of feel the deepening. So, anyways, it was very, I guess, heartwarming. I don't know exactly. It was very familiar for me to see it, and also very surprising because it's not something that I know that you intentionally, it seems, attempt to cultivate as a practice. But I wanted to point that out because in my history as a seeker and kind of with my former teacher, that was something that we considered to be actually very important in terms of like the realization of the nirmanakaya, which is that's kind of like, it starts to bring out kind of like the intelligence of it. Mm-hmm. And we called it incarnational non-duality, which is a little bit of a big word, but it's when we all kind of like the collective becomes enlightened through itself, and mm-hmm. related to kind of what Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about, that the Sangha at some point has to start becoming the vessel for enlightenment, not exactly. Just the teacher,
exactly,
and that can be done when we all lean in together kind of wholeheartedly, you know. And part of that though is like it's following a thread, you know, it's like it's taking something and taking it deeper together.
It's why we have a Dharma talk that has lots of time afterward for conversation. And it's the conversation that we remember. And the real teaching is in the conversation always. That's just a kind of unmentioned aspect of what we always do. Mm. We don't call it a certain kind of intelligence, but it certainly is that. It's a beautiful thing because every single person in the room is deeply wise and intelligent. And when we begin to share with each other, some new thing keeps growing and growing. The truth itself is coming through us. And we're encouraging and helping each other to understand better who we are and where we are. Thank you.
Carol.
You should remember my name.
Oh, it's a different kind of intelligence.
I know, right?
It's all one.
Yeah.
I was just wondering why do we keep our hands like this? Because I know that there's so many different mudras, those traditions, and we keep them like this still.
Yeah, and the Tibetans do a lot of them as they practice. It's very elaborate, kind of wonderful things that they do with their hands. This is called the cosmic mudra, and it's connecting both sides of us and then connecting the thumbs very gently and connecting this part of us and everything else around and around and around out beyond the Dharmakaya. So we sit with everything this way. Some people can't do it. Some people find it too powerful. And Coben told a friend of mine, just hold your thumb like this and just hold it against your belly and make sure that your breathing is just coming from the belly and going and then like this. So whether it's like this or like this, it's very condensed. It holds us in place, you could say.
What do you think those people meant when they said it was too powerful?
The friend who said that is very super sensitive. And I think her whole nervous system simply couldn't take so much. It's very energetic.
And a little bit, I've experimented with mudras. They each have their own energy. And this one is really, if it's a lot, it's really, I guess it could be too much.
Mm-hmm. So I have another unrelated question as well.
Please.
And that's more about, we've spoken about this before, but more about talking about practice in our life. Because especially when we spoke yesterday about about the chants, which is like just doing it, like even though you don't know it, why you do it. But when I go home, that's like the only question people ever ask when you do something. Like, why do you do it? And so getting into that, that's where it gets to be really iffy, that conversation. You know?
Trying to explain it.
Especially by not explaining it.
Yeah.
Which all makes a lot of sense.
Well, that's the hard part of our practice. You can't tell it. You have to experience it yourself. So all you can do is encourage people to do this. It's a doing. It's not a thinking thing. So it can't be explained. And some people don't like that. They get very frustrated. But and in our culture, we try to explain everything. So it's annoying to people to have something that can't be explained. But if you just... My analogy is swimming. That if you read books about swimming, you never know anything about how to swim. It just doesn't even make sense. You have to get in the water. So this is the water. And then you begin to develop questions. You know, what is this? And then it gets very interesting because you have an experience to talk about. But before then, you just have to encourage people to try. Taste it and see what you think. And not everybody will go there. It's scary for people. It's scary to feel like there's something you can't explain. So we're all pretty courageous people, actually. John?
You bring up an interesting subject, Angie, with the thumb positions. And I recall that Copeland used to teach back in the day not to keep thumbs tightly pressed together.
Yes.
And remember, he would lean forward and say, pretend you have an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper.
Yes.
And I can slide it through there.
Right.
And now I see a lot of people doing mm-hmm. very firm, not massage it as much as other signers, they keep a very firm position on their thumb.
It's too intense that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, this part is well connected with the not lining up the knuckles. But they say you just, it's like holding a very thin piece of paper between your fingers, between your thumbs. You don't want to be pressing down. Coben always said if you push it up like this, it means you're angry, that you actually are just overwhelmed with emotion. And if it's like this, if it goes down, it, you're really tired. Nico?
I found that when I try to keep my thumbs, at the tips of my thumbs, so that they're neither touching or not touching,
mm-hmm.
just like it becomes almost like an alternative to following the breath. I can just kind of keep in that non-touching, touching space, and it's like it becomes a focus of the something.
It's a good place if you've got them resting against your belly. Yeah.
You can kind of feel like there's an in-between spot where they're just managing to touch, but not quite really.
So yeah.
It's
yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
But this is just in response to what you were saying. So I do talk about mindfulness practice in the talks that I give with the kids that I'm speaking to. But I speak about it in terms of how the practice has kind of rewired my brain. And that it's kind of like one of the touchstones of hope that I feel that I offer them when their brains are so impressionable and malleable, to be able to say, you know, this is something you can do. I do it for 30 minutes every day, and it can change the experience that you're having.
Mm-hmm.
So I do speak about it.
Yes. Yeah, once people taste it, they get it. Yeah. And you're doing it with children, too. That's really important. They're doing that in schools in some places, just asking the children to be quiet mm-hmm. and sit and pay attention to their breathing. And 10 minutes of that will change a child. Oh, it helps so much. And if they're problem children, it helps with the problems. Yeah.
Right. I mean, and the response from the girls too. I mean, the ones that are really hurting, cutting, or the response is also amazing. Those are often the girls that'll take it on. It'll go home and like and try it, and then notice that it worked. That something about it, you know, helped ease.
Yeah. It's probably the best present you could ever give anybody. Just that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for the work you do.
We had a session in August with Yap and a group of people here. And after I was asked that same question, why do you do it? And I had a much easier time writing about it than talking about it, because I also write about what is the rewiring of the brain, you know, but that's more difficult to talk about to adults especially. Mm-hmm. So I had a long pause and then I said, I mean, it always goes back to what's closest to your heart, right? I said, for the same reason I play the piano, or maybe someone plays tennis, it feels good and it feels right. Mm-hmm. And something, that's what we do here on earth, right? We just do things that feel good, even when we kiss in a way, you know? And I think that made a few people curious.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's hard to talk about it, but that's right. But it's so good that you're sharing that. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's a wonderful response too, though, that it just feels right speaking from your experience. I think people kind of get that when you're that.
We can't talk about it, but we can sometimes express the consequence of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What really disconnects.
Mm-hmm.
So you say,
try it, you'll like it. Yeah.
I really like your response that you do it for the same reason that you play piano.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Angie, what is meant by skillful means?
We need a lot of it. And it simply means doing the best we can with the equipment that we were given as a human being to navigate the world and do no harm and open it up wherever we can.
It feels like a term I should understand intuitively, but it doesn't. I don't.
It means working, being willing to work with the situation and work with it skillfully, using the Dharma that you are connecting with, so that you're not trying to figure it all out, but you are using your intelligence and your emotions and all the things that you are in the best way to help a situation. And sometimes you have to be very, very tactful, and you have to wait a long time because things don't work out exactly, and it's just the way that we find our way through our life, whether it's with meetings with people or putting a sesshin together or undoing a sesshin will take some skillful means. Yeah. The other way is just to bluster on in and try to do it your own way, and then bump into people who want to do it their way, and then it gets to be very messy and unpleasant. So it's just being wise as we can be. David?
I heard it defined one time, Dhamma says, an appropriate response.
Oh, that's a very nice one. Yes.
If there's no response, if it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. No response if that's appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that, I think the difficult part can be stepping back enough to read the situation to know what is appropriate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's something I'm learning in my chaplaincy training is you don't usually have like some magic words to tell people when they're in the hospital or they're dying. And so much of the skills, quote unquote, is mostly just listening and just being there.
Yes.
And recognizing that you don't have the tools they have the tools they need.
Yes.
So just helping them with that.
Yes, that's wonderful. So that's an ongoing koan expressed as an appropriate response. That's very ancient, and it can be a torture to us sometimes. But it really is what skillful means is. And it isn't in a book, and it's not like last time either. Every situation is brand new. So that's the listening part. What is this situation exactly? How shall we do? Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I have one question about the Metta Sutta, actually. Because we chant, "Do not take upon oneself the burden of riches." And I'm just trying to figure out how you can marry that living in a society where, for example, it costs like $50,000 a year to send a kid to college. And so there's certain pressures that makes you think that that's really important. Mm-hmm. But still you're chanting that.
Well, it's about defining all those words. That $50,000 for a kid to go to college is a lot of money, but that's not riches. That's just enough money. So the whole question of money, of course, is a big one. How do we, and again, how do we skillfully navigate with money when we need it in order to survive? And so many people need it and don't have it. So our society gives us many challenges around the subject of money. But it's, I think, pointing to those who are tremendously ambitious and know how to make millions and don't let anything get in their way and just keep piling up the money. There are people like that. We know them. We know who they are. And they consider it even kind of a joke. I heard one of them interviewed not long ago. Said he just likes doing it. He likes making money. He doesn't like to spend it. But it is a burden, not only for that man, because he has to work constantly in order to protect it, but it's burdening everybody else as well. Because it's affecting the whole economic system that we're in a very difficult and painful way. So we don't have to go out and beg on the streets the way some of the monks do still in Japan, but we can be very mindful about how we manage money and how we cultivate generosity. If we want to find a way to express our gratitude for our life, helping others that way is really a good way.
I was just thinking when you said that, for some reason, both of you, what you were saying was, I learned in my daughter's first grade class, which was like 40 years ago, I helped out in the class sometimes, and she drew a picture of a big circle. This is a pie, you know. And we can talk about, you know, if it's fair or not. And she talked about the food and the resources in more simple language, I guess, but food, and took a big whopping slice out and said, okay, this is how much the United States uses, our country, mm-hmm. and this, you know, much smaller one, and this is the rest of the world. So what do you think about that? And they didn't have a problem with it. They didn't say anything.
The little children did?
Yeah.
Yeah, more is better, right? More.
Just the phrasing it as pie, they probably did it.
Yeah.
I'll sure. Take as much pie as I can.
Yeah. I've been thinking about the meal chant that we do twice a day about, there's two places in there about the word clinging and, you know, and on the second side, you know, thirdly, to have a natural order of mind to be free from clinging, we must be free from greed. Is that talking really about the ego, the attachment? I mean, what is that, you know, what is that line about?
It's
you know?
What we're like.
Me, mine. I mean, bigger?
Well, we call them three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion. So, greed is a big subject. I often think that each of us specializes in one of those. Some of us carry a lot of anger, and some of us more than the other two. Some of us carry a whole lot of greed. And it's expressed in a lot of different ways. I'm a greed person. It helps to identify your proclivity. And some people are just liking to walk around like this and try not to know anything. Not to be aware.
I would have thought delusion includes all the other two.
And it does include the other two. Yes. Yes, so it's just pointing to that just when you're hungry. It's very, not very subtle. It says, here's your food, you're hungry as heck, and better remember you're greedy. Yeah. They say orioki means just enough. And we take big scoops. Plop. In the bowl. David?
I think I'm a greedy one too. My teacher told me early on, I didn't know what he meant, but it's when I was just starting practice, I said, I'm not getting anything.
Yeah.
And he said, you're very greedy. And in retrospect, of course, I was expecting a drug experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the bells and whistles, as they say sometimes in Catholicism, or was it smells and bells in Catholicism? ecstatic experience. And
yes.
And you don't have it. You got your hand closed too tight. In case you're doing it.
Exactly. Exactly. Marie?
I was also noticing the line about the natural mind, free of clinging, which means free of greed. And I was connecting it with what you were talking about the other day. I believe it was you, I'm pretty sure. That really meant a lot to me when... I think it was a definition of enlightenment that instead of us, and I'm totally paraphrasing, instead of us reaching out to get something and practice the world, we allow the world to come and practice us. And I think that what happened for me is I was thinking about that grasping, because I really could identify with that. And I could also identify with times when I do feel the world coming to me, and that I always end up with just enough. And so I was thinking about that clinging and grasping have a lot in common physically. Mm-hmm. You know, I can feel it, whether it's mental or possession-wise. And then I had another thought that came from it about the greed. As I was really feeling that out, I felt that in my life, things that I needed at some point when I was younger, or at some point that I couldn't have, but especially younger and had less power to attain them or to receive them, I became greedy for them. It was like the need came out of greed. No, the greed came out of need. Mm. And that as I could let go of the clinging, trying to get that need met, which manifested in greed, then there was this sense of just the right amount coming to me.
Exactly. All of those three so-called poisons are very useful and helpful, including anger. It's just an energy. And sometimes you have to express something in an angry way that rises up when your child is about to be run over by a bus. You don't want to say, "Oh, dearie." You want to say, "Get the heck over here right now." It's important to know that. And even our ignorance is important. We don't have to know everything. We can allow things. We can let things go. But that's skillful means. It's knowing when it's useful and good and knowing when it's not. And it's different every time. Yeah. So you managed. And I think a lot of us manage that way. We really, really wanted something. And many of our needs are survival things. We need food. We need shelter. We need our life. So, as a young person, we develop that in a very big way sometimes. Very cool. Yeah, thank you. Well, we're kind of out of time from before, but I'm glad we had this conversation.